Hello everyone and welcome to episode 18 of Inside the WDF with me, Andrew Sinclair. You know, it's great to be back with you all, and it's also great to have seen in the last week the return of proper darts to our screens. Okay, it's not quite the same spectacle we're used to, but as always, the PDC have led the way with their organisation and their safety, and they deserve tremendous credit for being the first ones to take the plunge. Someone's always got to be first. We've seen that with other sports, you know, football, boxing. There's always got to be someone who goes first. Hopefully, there's some tips and practical guidance that countries within the WDF system can take when running their events that hopefully will be up and running from September onwards, really. I think it's going to be a slow return on our side of the sport. But tentatively, there are some events scheduled for September that are taking bookings. And of course, once the first ones go, hopefully that will lead to a number more. But of course, it's hard to comment too much at this stage with the pandemic and the times we're in, because things are changing quite rapidly. And by the time 2 months from now we're playing events, things could be very, very different. So we'll have to wait and see, but it certainly was great to see darts back and a tremendous standard across the 5 days of the summer series. I've got two guests for you on this episode of the podcast, both from the Netherlands, former BDO referee Marco Meyer and MC, commentator, referee and the voice of Dutch darts, Mr. Jacques Nulat. Two fascinating people and some really good chats with them about a variety of topics, so I hope you enjoy those. We'll get started, first of all, with my chat with Marco from last week about his decision to leave the BDO, how he got started in the refereeing side of the sport, his first world championship, some of his favourite memories over the years, and his future career goals. I'm delighted to be joined this evening by former BDO senior referee, Mr. Marco Meyer. How are you, Marco?
Yeah, I'm all good. Thank you very much. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Keeping well. How has the lockdown been for you in the Netherlands?
Well, the lockdown, it's the rules are a little bit better than in the UK so far. So we're still we're allowed to go out, and we're allowed to go with other people in the car and to see our friends and family. So it's a little bit better in all.
It was quite strange. The week before the lockdown came into effect here, I was actually over in Amsterdam for the weekend. So at the time, it didn't seem that strange. And then we came back to the UK and suddenly, you know, I was working from home, you know, from basically when I came back. So it's been a strange few months, definitely.
Yes, it is. It is really strange.
And I mean, what's it been like for you without darts? Because you've been a, you know, darts referee traveling all around the world for the last decade, really.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it's really weird. Well, I have a lot more time for friends and family now, but of course I really miss the darts and all the tournaments.
To look into the start of your refereeing career, how was it that you actually got into the refereeing counting side of things?
Well, I start in my local area. I live on the island just below Rotterdam, close to the beach, and we have a few tournaments a year, and then who decides who's the best darts player from that island. But I started playing when I was 13, 14 years of age, and I started playing at the tournaments. But from day one, I knew I'm never going to be good enough to win a tournament or to make a quarterfinal or something. But I always enjoyed it. I went with my friends, and I always marked the finals, because most of the time, the older guys didn't want to mark when they lose the semis or the quarters. So, and I was only 14, 15 years of age, and I thought, well, the marking is nice, so I always marked the finals. At one time, there was one guy who ref the finals, and he did it one or two times. And after that, I said, I think I can do it better than you. And he said, yeah, well, go ahead then. You do the next tournament, you can do the final. And then everyone said, maybe you have to do it more. So that's why in my local pub, for 20, 30 people, the people who were there at the tournament, I started doing it.
And I guess, what was the route from starting doing those things? See, what was the route from there to, you know, in 2011, when you made your TV debut at the Zwaardedijk Masters, which was won by Scott Waite?
I started to do it in my local area, and then there was an exhibition with Gary Anderson and Gary Robson. And the people who were organizing that, they see me a couple of times at the local tournaments, so they asked me, can you ref at the exhibitions? Well, I said, okay, I've never seen a dart player from telly in real life, so I thought, well, okay, well, let's try it. So I did the night. They played pairs together the whole night against other people from the pub, and I ref the whole night. And then Gary Robson asked me at the end of the night, okay, you did a good job, and for the you do this for a long time? I said, no, this is my fourth time. He said, okay. So he said, did you ever been to big tournaments like the Dutch Open or Belgium Open or whatever? I said, no, I only play darts here in my own pub and in my town, and that's it. So, but I knew some guys here from the area were going to the big tournaments. So I asked him, can I come with you? And then I met Gary Robson again, and he started having a few good words for me at the organization in Belgium. And in Holland, so that's why where it started.
You know, you weren't the Zwaardedijk Masters in your home country, and then, you know, barely a month later, you made your debut at the BDO World Championship. And I guess one of your career highlights really must have been the second half of the men's final, which you got to call when Christian Kist won the trophy.
Yeah, that was the weirdest 4 weeks I ever had in my life. But of course, it was. In 2010, I did my first Dutch Open, and after that, my goal was to do the Zwaardedijk Masters, of course. And, well, in 2011, he came to me, Gerard Eldron-Bos, that's the tournament director, he came to me and said, yeah, do you want to ref up my tournament? So, yeah, of course. And then, yeah, I did a lot of matches. I think I did a final as well in 2011 in Zwaardedijk. And then, yeah, 1 week later at the Dutch Championships, then I had a phone call from Maarten Fitzmaurice, because a lot of English darts players were on the way back, were talking to Maarten, well, it's a world championship, so why do you need only English referees? And he's from Holland, and we know him for a few years. So, yeah, that's where it started.
Christian, that week, he was the form player. He had the two highest averages of the tournament. And it was, you know, it was nice, I guess, for you to be able to call that second half of the final.
Yeah, that was maybe the biggest shock of the week. It was really, well, I was really surprised that I was at Lakeside, of course. But then, yeah, to do the final 9 days later, that was, well, a really big shock. It was amazing.
Worked to the BDO World Championship every year after that, up until, you know, 2019. But were there any other specific games or matches that really stood out to you?
Yeah, definitely. I think my greatest match ever was Martin Adams and Glenn Durrant in 2015, the semi-final. That went all the way to a tie rate, 6-5 in the semi-final. The ladies' final from Trina Gulliver, her 10th, was quite special. Not the average-wise, but the whole story around it was really good. Yeah, and yeah, I had some luck in the last couple of years. I was quite lucky, so I did some really good ones.
We talk about the BDO World Championship. Obviously, one of the many stories, you know, that wasn't too good for the BDO last year was when, you know, the whole refereeing team sort of left the organisation. Why was it that you specifically walked away?
Maybe this sounds weird and as a shock for a lot of people, but after the final in 2019, I didn't ref that final, but I already said to the team, I don't want to work for the BDO anymore. I want to give up. And that was my own opinion about it. I didn't have the confidence to work for the BDO anymore. I had enough after 8 years.
Was it more a case that you weren't happy with Des as, you know, chairman, or was it just you were looking at different things?
Well, we were looking at different things, and, well, it was that year was so much different than the other 7 years, and I didn't feel comfortable anymore. Well, for us at Team Ref, we are a really strong group, I think, and we are try to be professional for the players and for the stage and for the audience and for everyone. But, well, we didn't have the feeling that the professionalism came back to us. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I didn't have the feeling that we were going forward. So that was basically, yeah, I thought, do I want to do this? After this year, I did 8 years, I've seen everything, is this what I want to do? So, and then, of course, in July, I think it was June or July, then Richard said, I'd give my resignation to Des, to the BDO. And then after 1 second, I said, well, this was maybe the final decision, I want to give up as well. Because I think we're a team. Of course, it was for everybody, it was their own decision, but for me, it was a really easy decision. Of course, it was really difficult on the other side, because, yeah, it was... I love to do it. I love refereeing. And I always say I have the best seat in the house, especially at Lakeside, of course. But if you feel comfortable, or then I think you have to stop it.
It's strange in a sense with darts, because obviously, you know, as a refereeing team, you're all very close. But if you compare darts to, you know, other sports like tennis or football, the relationship between referees and players it's very different, because I know that, you know, you often travelled with a few of the Dutch players to events, whereas, you know, in football, tennis, whatever, you definitely wouldn't be allowed to do that.
No. Most of the time when I went to the UK, I travelled with Wesley, Hans, Richard Veenstra, Chris Landman, Kleermaker, all that guys. I travelled with them because, yeah, and Danny Noppert, of course, yeah, well, you can name them all, but yeah, it's a lot easier to go with four persons in the car than three and one, of course. It's a lot cheaper for everyone. The shows and for plane tickets, yeah, we did and it's nice to travel together. But yeah, you don't see that in a lot of sports, I think.
Talking of the team ref, when I spoke to one of your colleagues, Nick Rolls, back in April, he told me a story about the 2015 Dutch Open and Daryl Fitton's 9-darter in the final. I guess, what was your perspective on that?
No, I can't remember anything. because it is the Dutch Open, Nick and myself agree that I always do the men's final because it's, I'm from Holland and it's the Dutch Open, blah, blah, blah. So he said, you can do the men's final. And I said, well, it's fine. I don't mind to do the ladies' final or whatever, but he said, it's your tournament, so you can have the men's final. But that year was Daryl Fitton in the final. And I know that Daryl and Nick are really good mates. Not that it doesn't matter if you're really good mates at the stage, but I thought, why not to swap finals, that I do the ladies' final. So I think I had Lisa Ashton first. I can't even remember. So I said, do you want to swap? Because it's Daryl Fitton in the final. He said, yeah, is that okay with you? I said, yeah, it's not a problem. I finished the ladies' final. I went into the audience to all my mates, because we are over there with 30 people, I think, at the Dutch Open. So I was finished. So I took my bow tie off and my jacket off, and I was having a beer in the audience. And then first one ate one in, and well, that's normal. And then the second one ate one in, and I thought, no way, this is never going to happen. I swapped one final in 11 years, and then travel, and the double 12 went in, and more than 3,000 people went absolutely crazy. Well, me too. And then I thought, oh, oops. And then when the Adams won, of course, and then the final was over, so I waiting for Nick, and we were so laughing about it. But yeah, it was, I never forget it. But I was really happy for Nick that he ref the 9-darter for Daryl, of course. But on the other side, well, it was nice that I have won as well, because it's now 4 times miss on double 12. But maybe one day, you never know.
Well, you got to hope. And I know that you and Nick won a game in the pairs tournament this year's Dutch Open, so you're all still getting on well.
Yeah, that's the only tournament we play, well, big tournament we play every year. We play pairs and the Dutch Open. Why, we don't know, because it's definitely a waste of money. But yeah, we won the game, so it's good fun. And I had the lowest average on the TV link from the whole tournament, so I was quite proud of myself.
And I guess, you know, one of the perils of being a referee in a big event is if you make a mistake, a lot of people will see it. 2014, the Dutch Open final is memorable. You know, Ross Montgomery won, but I also remember that you made an error in the counting, which I think helped Ross win. I get you're going to be able to explain what happened a little bit better than me, but also what were your, you know, emotions afterwards?
First, I'll start to explain what's happening in the final. The Dutch Open final is best of five sets, best of five legs. I mean, it's 2-0 in sets and 2-0 in legs. The fifth leg is a deciding leg, so there's no tiebreak rule and everything. So the fifth leg is deciding leg. 2-0 sets and 2-0 in legs. Ross Montgomery is on 121, I think, after 9 or 12 darts, I can't remember. Maybe after 15, it doesn't matter. And he's on 121, and he hits single 20, treble 17, and he wants the bullseye for the Dutch Open title, but he hits a 16. So there's 87 scores, but I shied at 93. So, nothing wrong. So Scott waits on the other side. He's, I think, on 155. And he scored 131 to leave 24. So they're both on a double to win the Dutch Open. But Ross was first. I shouted 131, and then Ross, you require. And the moment I looked at a scoreboard, I know, okay, I'm wrong. Because normally when you miss the bullseye, you always have or 25 left or 30 or higher, if that makes sense. And I looked at it, and before I realized, I shouted 28, and he waited a second, and he hit single 14, bang, double 7. And I had to say game short in the match and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I miscounted, and I think I was, well, I don't want to make an excuse, but I think I was already start practicing in my head how to say my final lane after the winning double. And yeah, I made a mistake, a big mistake. And if this was happening in the second leg, in the second set, no one mentioned it. But yeah, of course, now this was a dark page in my career, I think.
And I guess, what was your reaction after the tournament? You know, you'd called it, you know, Ross had had the presentation, then you kind of had some time with your own thoughts. What was your response then?
Well, I didn't see anything from the presentation because I shook hands with the refs and then, with the players, and then I walked off. And one NDB official saw something. He saw that something was wrong with me, and I went to the back and I went outside. And he came to me and said, "What happened?" And he said, "Yeah, this is the story." And then I was so angry at myself. I said, "How can this happen?" And then I went back to my room for more, I think, more than an hour and a half with my girlfriend at that time. And I was so angry at myself. But after that, I had a shower and everything. And then I had dinner, and then we had a few drinks. And then after that, later at night, I had a chat with Ross and Scott about it. Yeah, and I said to Scott, "I'm really sorry." And well, funny stat, then 8 days later, or a week later, was the BDO World Trophy in Blackpool. And then in the second round or quarterfinal, there was Scott Waits and Rod Montgomery were playing together. Little Richard gave me that match, of course. And in that match, Ross left and Scott left, I think, 5 times 121. And then every time then you remember it, everything. But yeah, that was maybe the best lesson, that 8 days later I had to ref the same match. That was probably the best thing ever.
One final note on the Dutch Open. You know, the last few years have been dominated by British players, so it must have been nice for you last year when you ref the men's final that, you know, one of your travelling partners, Richard Veenstra, won the title.
Yeah, that was really nice, and it was really a long time ago that a Dutchman won, so yeah, that's really nice, especially for the Dutch audience, of course.
I know, after you left the BDO officially as a senior referee last year, you were still doing WDF events and so on. But I also know that you were, you know, worked one of the European Tour events with the PDC last year. Is that the route you're looking to pursue going forward?
No, I didn't do a European Tour event. I did the German Super League finals for Nico Kurz, who won it last year. I did that for the PDC Europe.
But is the PDC route the option you're trying to look at moving forward?
Well, of course, that's my... That would be really nice if that's ever going to happen in the future. But yeah, you never know. And well, what a WDF at the moment, because there are big things going to happen in the future with a WDF, like everyone knows. So I want to try help Richard and Nick, team members from Team Ref. We're going to try our best to realize everything in the future. But yeah, of course, my main goal will be really, that will be the cherry on the cake. You never know. I'm still young. So,
you know, you're definitely heading in the right direction with the, you know, the experiences and stuff that you've had. And hopefully you'll be back refereeing tournaments soon, and you'll be able to watch your beloved Ajax as well.
Yeah, well, hopefully, yeah. Hopefully we can start playing darts a little bit, but hopefully the big tournaments are coming back at the end of the year.
Thank you so much for your time, Marco, this evening. I really appreciate it, and I hope you stay safe and stay healthy.
No problem, Andrew. It's a pleasure, and stay safe, and speak to each other soon, mate.
I hope you enjoyed that chat with Marco. He's a lovely bloke and I really enjoyed talking to him. Hopefully one day he will get that 9 data. He's very, very close. And hopefully next time the decision to take or not take a game will go in his favour. Marco, you know, and the rest of Team Ref leaving the BDO was one of the stories of 2019 in our side of the sport. And on the note of the BDO, since I was last with you with a traditional monthly episode of the podcast, we've seen the commercial arm of the company go into liquidation. There's no real update yet on that process. We were told we were going to get one today, but I've not seen anything yet. So presumably there wasn't anything too inflammatory that counties wanted to share, or perhaps it's very confidential, or perhaps I've missed it. What I have seen isn't too promising, but I haven't got anything concrete, so I think it would be remiss for me to comment. And truth be told, it's, you know, legal stuff that I don't know what's actually possible to do, whether certain companies can buy assets or debt, or I don't know. It's not really my bag. But we have seen real development on the county side of things with the three competing proposals for the future of grassroots darts. You've got, of course, the BDO, who want to maintain the BICC system. You've got the Tri-Nations Dart, formed by directors from England, Scotland and Wales, closely linked to the national organisations. And then you've got the United Kingdom Darts Association, the UKDA. Of course, the UKDA are the newest to the scene, with some people on their management committee that might not be familiar names to many of you, but since I last recorded that the UKDA put out their final proposal, which I was really impressed by. Slick presentation, very clear, lots of stuff from the old system that they want to keep, which is good because people don't like too much change, so there's a lot that stays the same. But it looks costed effectively, and there are some real positive steps. I think the introduction of reduced gym membership for UKDA members is a huge thing. I think, you know, looking after the physical and mental health of everyone is going to be hugely important going forward. And we've seen how important it is over the last few months, so I think that's a really nice step. And it's a real professional step as well. I think they're partnering up with, you know, anti-bullying charities and stuff. I think that's fantastic. And of course, their working relationship that they've already established with Dark Connect, unlike the BDO who announced they'd entered negotiations with the people at Dark Connect. Since the UKDA put their proposal out, they managed to get 8 counties or organisations to sign up to become members of the UKDA, and they are Cleveland, Shropshire, Salopian and Darts, Kent, Derbyshire, Carmarthenshire, Clwyd, and of course the big one that actually came out, you know, a couple of hours before I started recording this was Lancashire. I got tipped off that, you know, perhaps one of the big names was going to make the jump to the UKDA, but I wasn't sure how it would play out. So it's hard to underestimate how important I think that is in the landscape of the way this county decision goes. Because Lancashire, because of their connection with Tommy Thompson, they were expected to be the linchpin of the Tri-Nations system and proposal. And, you know, seeing a county of that size make a big decision will influence the behaviour of a number of others. You know, to see one of the biggest in terms of their membership make that decision, it's really going to influence some of the smaller ones who are perhaps undecided and think, well, you know, if the big boys are going to go for it, well, we probably should too. But I think it's also going to influence a number of the other big ones who think, right, well, you know, if they're going for it, it's going to influence some people. And I think it really, really is significant and could be, you know, it could be the moment people look back on and say, well, you know, they got 7 over the line, but they were the ones who really, really made a difference. I think the BDO retaining the county's fees from the you know, abruptly ended 1920 season, I think that's still going to hold sway for a lot of counties. But I think that could well change as more information about the liquidation process comes out. And I also feel, ultimately at the end of the day, I'm not sure that's going to matter too much, because I think the UKDA have got real momentum. It's looking very positive for them. And I think, as I've said, this move for Lancashire could be a massive boon for their chances. I spoke to the vice chairman of the UKDA, Colin Savage, at the end of last month for a feature in the Darts Planet TV magazine. And I managed to release it as a podcast for you all as well, and got really good positive feedback on it. And I'd recommend you check that out on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Colin spoke very eloquently about their proposals, went into it in a lot more detail. And I think it's a really positive listen for someone who's involved in the county system, but also someone who's just intrigued and wants to learn more about this debate and conversation that really is going to shape the future of the side of our sport in Britain domestically. We've also seen, since I last recorded, the announcement of Modern Amateur Darts, which is the brainchild of Steve Brown, who's probably one of the hardest working men in darts, really, with his work with the JDC and now being back as a PDC tour card holder. It looks very interesting. You know, the stuff I've seen, I think there's some very cool stuff in there with the ideas of franchises and regionalised franchises, affiliating with local opens. I think there's some really good ideas in there. But at the moment, I do feel like I'm in the sceptical camp. I think I'm a naturally sceptical person, so I was perhaps expecting that. But I certainly feel, it's a case of endorsements, perhaps over substance in some ways. You know, and we still don't know concretely what the MAD system is going to look like domestically, you know, internationally, the long-term goal. He's spoken very well. Steve's interview with Phil Bars was a good listen, but I think we're still waiting to see more from them. So I think it's remiss to comment too much, but count me interested, but I think also count me a sceptic for the moment. Anyway, a man who knows all about, you know, the amateur side of the game, but also the professional side of the game, is Jacques Nulat. You know, Jacques and I caught up last week to discuss his thoughts on, you know, the rise of online darts, his website mastercaller.com, mastercaller.nl, the decline of the BDO, the future hopes of the WDF, the retirement of Raymond van Barneveld, someone he's worked with extensively over the years, and a lot more. So I hope you enjoy. I'm now delighted to be joined by veteran MC, referee, and the voice of Dutch darts, Mr. Jacques Nieuwlaert. How are you, Jacques?
I'm very well, Andrew. Thank you very much.
And how have the last few months been for you in the coronavirus lockdown?
Oh, it's been quiet, to be honest. It came a bit sudden, I have to admit. I was in Exeter March 5th for the Premier League. Did a few interviews there for the Dutch TV. And then March 12th, I did the commentary on the Premier League as well. And then all of a sudden, March 13th, I think everything closed down here. And we were in, well, not the same lockdown as they were in the UK, but we were also advised to stay at home, don't go to work. And obviously, there's no darts around. So I've been basically at home for the last 4 months or so.
So I bet you were glad to see the PDC back today with the first event in their summer series.
Yeah, it's always nice to get things going, and it took a lot of effort to get it started, but it's great that everything has gone well, everyone's healthy, it's the most important thing, of course, and, well, the whatever we hear back from the players is that they enjoy it to be playing again, so that's always good.
Definitely, it certainly feels strange seeing two players on an hockey again, but I mean, one of the things we have had in the lockdown is that the real rise in online darts. What have you... You know, as someone who's been around the sport a number of years, what have you made of the online darts?
I'm probably not the best one to ask. I love darts, but the all the home stuff and the online stuff, it didn't get me. It didn't pull me towards my computer, to be honest. I watched a little bit of it. Obviously, I followed the results, but it's not for me, to be honest. There has to be a bit more than just two dart balls and someone sitting in the middle talking about it. It's not enough for me. I miss the crowd. I miss the passion.
Very much not the same, and I have to agree with you. It's hard to watch for long periods. I think that was my assessment. I could watch the odd game, especially if, you know, it was a decent game, good quality, but I think long term it just wasn't the same sort of spectacle as we're used to. But obviously you haven't had, you know, any darts really to commentate on. And we've seen, you know, commentators in other sports have been practicing commentary in their own homes on, you know, people going by out the window, that kind of thing. Have you been doing any practice commentaries at home?
No. I think I've had enough practice over the last few years. I did do a few interviews for RTL with some players via Zoom or via Skype, which we use for our online platforms. But there was only, I think, we did about 5 or 6 days, and then 5 or 6 players each day. So it kept me going. But again, even in the interview, you want to sit face to face with people. It's different doing it via a computer. Mm. And if you use the online stuff, I did play online, but I played myself, and that it's fun. Mm. I just used the Dart Connect system, and I played myself with friends across the pond or with friends across the Netherlands. I like that.
Mm. Another thing that has been keeping you busy, I mean, your website, mastercaller.com, is a huge resource, especially for someone like me. You know, it's sort of an encyclopedia for darts over the years. And, you know, over the, you know, the last few weeks and months, you've been writing a number of articles on sort of the history of the World Cup and the Europe Cup. What prompted you to do that?
Well, obviously, with not so much work to do, you try and keep yourself busy. So what I did basically is, I've got my own database, which I use in commentary. So all the results from all the various TV, but also all the floor tournaments are in there. And also the WDF Cups are in there. There's not much to find on the WDF Cups, to be honest, online. And a lot of the information is probably also not 100% correct. So I thought, well, I'm going to give myself a go. Went through all the programs. Got friends and other people that are interested in dart stats to hand me their programs as well, and then I just started basically collecting all the results, and then I thought, well, I might just as well write a little article for each year. At first, I have to admit, I didn't think it'd be that much work, but it's quite a bit of work, because every cup has got 5, 6, sometimes 8 or 10 events. And every event you want to do a little story on, so it became bigger and bigger and bigger, but I thought it was fun, and then I did it for the website, and then I thought, well, I might just as well share it on Facebook and Twitter as well. Maybe other people will enjoy it as well. And I've heard a lot of good feedback of it, so I guess people like it. People forget, and this is the past, so I think I'm now in this century, but I started with the first one in 1977, and obviously not a lot of people remember what happened in 1977, nor did I wasn't there personally. But you do get a lot of feedback from people who were there or who remember things, players who played in national teams. It was nice. Yeah, it's nice.
Your website, when did that start, and have you always been passionate about the historical and the data side of the game?
Well, when I started the commentary, it was, what can I say, around the turn of the century. There wasn't a lot available at that time. There was no internet to get stuff off, so you had to collect things yourself. So I started collecting data and I started collecting results because I needed it in my commentary. So I went to players, asking them, where were you born? When were you born? Are you married? Just because I needed stuff to say during the broadcast. It became more, it grew, and it was in Excel sheets. It was really difficult to keep collecting stuff and keeping it accurate. So I think about 10 years ago, a friend of mine asked me if I was interested in having someone build me a database. So the results go in and you can take stuff out of it, basically, at your own request. And I said, well, we started building it. I think you might regret it now because 10 years later, it's become pretty big. And from the database, a little bit from the database goes to mastercaller.com. Not everything, because you want to keep some stuff for yourself, because otherwise you're doing all the work and all the others only profit off it.
It is an incredible resource. Looking at your career, I know you mentioned there you started working in the commentary for RTL turn of the century, but when was it that you actually got started in the emceeing, refereeing side of things? And what was it that kind of interested you about that side of things?
Well, I started playing myself back in 1988, so it's a long time ago. I was still a youth player back then. And I used to play in the pub that was run by Roland Scholten. He used to be the bartender in that pub. And I used to play my local league there. And he said, well, you've got a bit of talent, so maybe you want to travel with me through the tournaments, ranking tournaments in the Netherlands. I said, yeah, I'll do that. But I was too young to drive, so I couldn't drive myself. So Roland always used to drive together with Raymond van Barneveld and with Bert Vladingerbroek, which was a really big name back then. And they basically took me with them. And the deal was always, because I couldn't afford petrol, that I would mark their matches. And in return, I could drive with them to the tournaments. So I basically spent all day marking matches for them because they always used to go very deep in the tournaments, obviously. And the winners had to mark, and they hated marking. So I did all the marking. Then Roland became world champion in 1993 in Las Vegas. He won the World Cup. And then he got some exhibition work. And then he said to me, basically, well, there's no one in Holland doing emceeing. And he had seen some exhibitions in England by Eric Bristow and by Bobby George, and they all had an MC with them during the night. And he said, can't you buy a suit and grab a microphone and we'll see where we go? And that's basically where I started. And because I was the first one to do it, quite quickly the Dutch Darts Federation asked me whether I could do a few tournaments for them. That got me onto the Dutch Open stage. Basically that's how it got going. I got to know a few of the dart players. I got to know Bobby George in England, and he asked me to come over to do a counting match for him, which I did, which also was a great experience. It's all about experience and broadening your horizon, basically. And that got me into the emceeing bit.
And where was it that you got your nickname, the Human Calculator?
Oh, I can't remember, to be honest. It must be in the Netherlands. We weren't so used to darts as you are in England. We don't have the history like you have. So when I used to do some refereeing for Roland or for the Dutch Darts Federation, the local newspapers, they used to come round and do an interview. And one of them actually said, well, when you're on stage, it's amazing. How can you count that quick? You're like a human calculator. I guess that stuck because he wrote it in the newspaper and that's where it started. And you can't get rid of it once you've got it.
I mean, you mentioned there, you know, you were the first non-British referee to referee a British county game. I believe you were also the first international referee at the Lakeside. Were there any particular games from that era that stand out to you?
So we used to do, back in the day, a friendly match between England and the Netherlands, and or England and Europe, and it was always played at the Lakeside. So I refed at the Lakeside, but not for the World Championship, but for those friendly games. I remember I played as well, because Netherlands was one player short, so I played one match. I played Sean Gray match, and I went 1-0 up. He was scared then. But that's all I remember. No, I'm not big on remembering my own matches. I'm bigger on remember other people's matches.
I know you've been involved, you know, over the last decade plus with, you know, the Europe Cups and the World Cups with the WDF. I mean, what is it like to work in those events where, you know, obviously they're an enormous sort of spectacle because of the number of countries you have, but they're not so well known to the outside world because they're not really sort of, certainly in Britain, they're not normally televised or anything like that.
No, nor are they. I always say I'm favorite tournaments of the year. I always look forward to the World Cups and the Europe Cups because it brings darts back to basically to the basis, because everyone that plays there plays for the pride of their country. You don't play for money, you just play for medals, but most importantly you play for your country. And when you're on stage like I am, and you call out the players, especially for the opening ceremony or for the closing ceremony, if you look at the pride on the faces of the players, especially from the smaller countries, because they are proud, they represent their country at a World Cup. It's a big thing. And I've always said it, it's a shame that it's not broadcasted, or it's not broadcasted anymore at least, because some of the best matches you'll see are in the World Cup, because there's no pressure of ranking points, no pressure of money. But there's pressure on doing it, not just for yourself, but also for your teammates and your country. It brings a whole new dynamic to the game. And especially the team games, I love. I always have said the team game of the World Cup should be an international televised tournament. It's so, so good, because it's always exciting. And it's very difficult to predict. Sure, in 40 years ago, it was always one of the British countries that won. But lately, you see a lot of different countries coming through, and you see countries like Australia, or the Netherlands, of course, Belgium, countries like Canada, the USA, that really do well in these tournaments. And I think it's a spectacle. It's more than just man v man, it's team v team. And it's more difficult to hit a double when you're doing it for your team than it is when you're doing it just for yourself.
We saw last year the World Cup went to Romania, and of course, Darren Herawini from New Zealand won the men's singles, which was obviously, you know, a big moment for him and a big moment for the country of New Zealand as well.
Yeah, of course, and Mikuru Suzuki winning it for the ladies, and you see in the youth as well, so many countries. Czech Republic did really well in the youth. It's a stepping stone for a lot of players, and that's why I think it deserves more attention than it's getting at the moment. And I'm pretty sure that in the future, if the WDF gets a hold on darts a little bit stronger than it has now, I think there's a future for the World Cup, and especially, I'll say it again, especially for the team events. I know the singles is always something we look at, and that's where the titles come from, but the team event is so, so spectacular, even in the group phases when the not-so-well-known countries are playing each other, because they fight for the pride of their country. That's something special.
And most definitely. And I guess, you know, you mentioned the WDF there. I know you're involved with them, and they've got big plans. I'll ask you about that in a minute. But obviously we've seen, you know, over the last week and months and years, really, the decline of the BDO. And of course, their commercial went into liquidation last week. Was that a sad day for you?
Well, it is in a way. Obviously, it's difficult. I always say I live on both sides of the fence, because I'm also obviously doing a lot of commentary for the PDC. I am a director for the PDPA. I also work for the WDF as an MC and as a referee. So I get to see a little bit of everything. It's not a big surprise that the BDO went the way it went for me as a non-British man. Because from our point of view, outside of Britain, the BDO wasn't... The only thing the BDO gave us was Lakeside and the Win My World Masters, basically. we don't have anything to do with the county system or whatever, because our national organization runs that. So for us, maybe the shock wasn't as big. We always thought, why does the BDO organize the World Championship? It's strange, isn't it? I mean, surely FIFA would not let the FA run the World Championship in football, would they? Yeah. And that's basically what happened in darts. So I understand it's a historical thing, and it's kept that way. But to me and to a lot of people from mainland Europe and possibly from around the world, it was always a little bit strange. Why doesn't the world governing body, the WDF, organize the World Championship, the biggest tournament on that side of the art? So again, it's sad because it's got a long history, but for international darts, it might not be so bad, because it gives other people a chance to get involved, possibly, and to create a new era in darts.
The COVID-19 pandemic has obviously thrown a spanner in the works for the WDF, but are you confident that, you know, the team they've got on board and the plans they've got, they can fill that void that's been left by the BDO?
I think they can. It's a shame that the COVID-19 came, because they were very, very, I know they were very, very close to announcing two majors. I mean, it's not a big secret that they're looking at a World Championship lakeside style, and they're looking at a World Masters style event. But in order to do that, you need to have the security of the funds. So that's the most important thing. And the one thing the BDO and the WDF have in common is that they are without funds, basically. So the system, the structure has to be redone one way or another. There has to come money from the countries and being fed into the WDF. Otherwise, you cannot organize big tournaments. It cannot come from sponsorship alone at the moment, because if you want sponsors, you need to provide them with something they can sponsor. And if you don't have that, it's a chicken and the egg story, we call it in the Netherlands. I don't know if that translates very well, but you need the tournaments to get TV, and you need TV to get the sponsor, and you need the sponsor to get the tournament, and you run around in that circle. And unless someone says, all right, here I am, I'm going to do one of those three things, it's going to be at a standstill. So I think the funds is the most important thing. Somewhere the funding needs to come from.
Funding and the social media and all that sort of thing, the presentation element is hugely important.
Yeah, that also comes with funds. If you've got money, you can pay people to do certain stuff. You mustn't forget that the WDF is run by volunteers alone. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something from the past. You cannot do that anymore. If you look at the PDC, people compare the PDC to the WDF or to the BDO. It's not a fair comparison. The PDC is a company. They've got people employed to do work. The WDF doesn't have that. So they lean very heavily on a few volunteers. And the nations that are in the WDF also rely on volunteers. So it's a completely different structure. It's easy to say that they're not doing a good job, but if no one comes forward to help them, it's not going to change. So the WDF will need people to help them out, but they also will need employed people, I'm confident of that, employed people to help them to progress. It's in Holland, it's quite common. I play local league in Delft, which is a city in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. I pay €40 a year to the Delft Darts Association to play in the local league. €10 of that money goes towards the Dutch Darts Federation. And they can run their system through my money. That's how it should be. Everyone in Holland who plays darts, which is about 30,000 to 35,000 people, they all pay €10 towards the running of the national organization. Therefore, Holland is the richest organization in the world. But they also have two or three people permanently working in the office to run the darts. That's why it's run so well in Holland. No volunteers. There's few volunteers, but not too many. There's paid people, and paid people will deliver your job. And that's what the WDF basically should do as well. I've said in the past, from my €10 that goes towards the NDB, basically €5 should go to the WDF. If every country in the world would do that, we would have a big world championship at the end of the year. No problem at all.
Definitely. When you say it like that, it, you know, it sounds so simple. But obviously trying to get every country on the same page isn't always easy. But I guess another element, you know, of the WDF, I know one of their long-term goals is to make darts an Olympic sport. Do you think that's a practical aim? And I guess if it was, how would that do you think look?
Oh, it's a difficult one. I support why they want to have Olympic recognition, because in a lot of countries, the nations, the darts federations in the nations get funding if they have Olympic status, which obviously generates money. Again, we're coming back to the money, but that's what it is. It generates money, and your sport could become Olympic later on. It's not when you join the IOC, you immediately are in the Summer Olympics. It doesn't work like that. But it's a slow process, and getting recognition by the IOC, which they're working on very hard at the moment, will open up funds to darts worldwide. And that's what we need. We need people in Mongolia, in Africa, in Southern America to start playing darts. If the darts community gets more global, more money will come in, more money will bring more talent, and more talent will bring us closer to the actually being an Olympic sport. But that's going to be a long, long journey. I don't think I will live to see it. And I'm not 50 yet, so I'm a young man.
Just a last couple of things from me. Obviously, you mentioned at the start that, you know, you really sort of got your break through the exhibitions that you did with Roland Scholten. And obviously, I know you do a lot of exhibitions now with, you know, Co Stompy, Raymond van Barneveld. And obviously, Raymond retired at the start of the year. As someone who's, you know, worked with him a lot over the years and commentated on countless of his games for Dutch television, did you think it was the right time for him to walk away?
No, I thought it was late. We still talk a lot. We used to live almost next door to each other. When was that? I'd say 30-odd years ago. We used to be very close. And we still are. We still drink a cup of coffee now and again, and we talk a lot. And I said to him as well, I said, I think you've, even when he announced it, I said, you shouldn't announce it that much in front of when you're quitting. But he had an idea about how he wanted to do that last year. It didn't work out for him, which is a shame. I really wished he would have had a better last year. I wished he would have had a last year like Phil Taylor had a last year, because in the Netherlands, he is the biggest name there is. And I think he has done more for the sport worldwide as well than a lot of people give him credit for. The BDO, when all the PDC players went away, the BDO really was lucky that Van Barneveld won the World Championship when he won it, because Dutch television got interested, money came in. Basically, the BDO was in a bad position back then as well, but Van Barneveld basically saved the BDO. The new tournaments coming in the Netherlands. Then when he switched to the PDC, you've got to remember, when he switched, no one in Holland almost knew about the PDC. The PDC was a very small darts club, basically. I remember when the Phil Taylor and I think it was Kevin Painter final, the really exciting one. I can't remember the year. You got to give me that. I can't remember. But I know the final day of that World Championship was the first day of Lakeside. And we had a match between a Scottish player and I think it was a Scandinavian player at the same time that final was going on a different channel in the Netherlands. And we had six or seven times as many viewers to our match than the PDC had to their final. And our match was a first round match between two players, not even from the Netherlands. So back then, that was how the position was in the Netherlands. And it was in a lot of countries the same. When Van Barneveld switched to the PDC, all the attention came to the PDC. And it came at the right time, I think, because the PDC also needed someone to challenge Taylor. And Van Barneveld, the first couple of years he went over, he really did challenge Taylor. And I think that's when the growth of the PDC really came about. A lot of players followed Van Barneveld in going to the PDC. Players like Mervyn King, Gary Anderson, they all followed in his footsteps. Van Gerwen, Klaassen. So, I don't think he always gets the recognition that he deserves in that way. But, I would say, as well, the last couple of years, you could see the end coming, basically. He didn't, the fire was gone, a little bit. But I think it's natural.
You mentioned a couple of other names there, you know, Jelle Klaassen and Michael van Gerwen, of course. You look now, there's so many Dutch players over in the PDC who are, you know, all exceptionally talented. Do you think the I guess also this year as well, I mean, You know, you had the likes of Martijn Kleermaker, you know, winning the tour card, Wesley Harms finally moving over to the PDC. And, yeah, I mean, you've still got guys on the WDF side, the likes of Richard Veenstra, who are, you know, tremendously gifted too. Do you think Dutch darts is as strong as it's ever been?
Yeah, I think we are lucky the way that we live in a small country. So it's quite easy to play against the other good players, which helps, obviously. And I can't say it enough. Dutch darts is really well organized and really, really well funded. So the Dutch darts organization helps players to gain international experience, for instance. If you're in the top of the rankings in the Netherlands, they will help you to travel a few tournaments in Europe, which where you gain, again, experience. So the players that go eventually towards Lakeside already have a lot of experience. And once they've done a few years of Lakeside, then they normally switch towards the PDC, which is, for us in the Netherlands, a natural way of doing it. And then but when they get to the PDC, they're basically also ready to go into the PDC. And especially the youth system in the Netherlands is really, really good. We always seem to come up with a lot of good youth players. Not all of them make it into the seniors, but when we deliver them, when they're 18, they're usually pretty good.
Big thank you for so much of your time this evening, Jack. I really appreciate it. It's been fascinating talking to you.
You're welcome.
I hope you enjoyed that chat with Jacques, and if you've got this far, thank you very much for listening. As always, your support's greatly appreciated. Like, rate, review on the podcast platforms if you can or you want to. All positive feedback is always welcome. And I guess the last thing really I wanted to touch on was, you know, the revised WDF calendar for 2020. We of course know, as Jacques was saying, that the WDF were very close to announcing their, you know, World Master Style and World Championship tournaments for the end of the year. And of course that's really had to be put on ice. And it's hard to tell how they would work out, or whether, in a sense, that the last few months of 2020 are going to be placeholder for something much bigger in 2021. As things stand, the first ranking WDF event back will be the first weekend of September, and there will be the Windmill Iceland Open and the Iceland Masters. It's going to be a new venue this year, I understand, in Iceland. It is quite expensive to go out there, and I don't know that prize money is perhaps the most appealing to players. That's the reaction I've seen so far, but to be honest, I think they could actually get quite an interesting field, because I think a number of players will be very keen to be back playing again after such a long absence. You know, the last events were the Isle of Man Festival in the middle of March. So I think a lot of players will be keen to go. Hopefully be good field over there. And I think it'll be very interesting to watch those events streamed on YouTube, Live Darts Iceland. They do a tremendous job. And of course, Dart Connect. I think it'll be very interesting to see how things work and the protocols they take, because, of course, the Icelandic ranking events have been taking place. You know, at the moment, we had four events over the weekend. So it'll be interesting to see how the ranking events play out over there and the steps they take to ensure everything is, you know, COVID secure and COVID friendly. The weekend after that is provisionally the England Open and the England National Singles at Selsey. And again, in theory, they're going to be much, much bigger events with a lot more people involved. Traditionally quite big field to those events, a couple hundred people at least. So it'll be interesting to see how the fields are affected this year by COVID, but also just, you know, the precautions again they take. I think that side of things would be very interesting. But beyond that, there are also events scheduled in September in Malaysia, Taiwan, Canada. Nothing too big. Obviously, you know, the England Open is the big one, but I know the Iceland events got bumped up, so they're silver category events now as opposed to bronze. As far as I know, the Iceland events could well be the first ones to have MAD ranking points. Now, again, further to what I was saying a little bit earlier in the show, I'm not exactly sure what they'll mean, but we'll have to see what the sands of time show us. Hopefully, when we're, you know, the monthly episode in August, I'll be able to talk about those events in a bit more detail. Hopefully, we'll know more about entries, what's going ahead, what isn't, and a fuller schedule for the remainder of the year. But, of course, the times we're living in now, things are very dynamic, things are in flux, so could change an awful lot by then. Beyond that, thank you very much for listening, and thank you very much to Jacques and Marco for coming on the show. I'm really grateful for their time. Really enjoyed talking to them, and I hope you enjoyed listening as well. Been continuing with the Golden Arrow series throughout July, so last couple of weeks I've released chats with Mike Gregory, the 1992 BDO World Championship runner-up, and last week I spoke to you know, the former host of the BDO Darts at the Lakeside, Mr. Ray Stubbs. Really enjoyed talking to him about his time, you know, his transition from football to working in the media industry, and then his move from a producer at the Darts to a presenter, his working relationship with Bobby George, and some of his favourite memories. So I'd encourage you to check that one out. It's a real different perspective from the view of the players. And later this week, I'll be releasing episode 11 in the series with Australia's Wayne Weening. Chatted for over an hour to Wayne, and he had some cracking stories. A brilliant career as well that he's now kind of getting the chance to live again through his son, who's an up-and-coming player in Australia. Next week, episode 12, will be with the three-time world champion John Lowe, one of the all-time greats of the sport. And then hopefully to round out July, I'll also have a chat with Russell Stewart, who for a time was world number two and was recently listed by Paul Nicholson as one of his, you know, five most underrated players of all time. I hope you're able to follow and listen to all that content when it comes out, and also enjoy everything else in the Golden Arrows series on Podbean, iTunes or Spotify or wherever you get podcasts. Hope you enjoy the episode, and I hope you all stay safe, stay healthy, stay well, and I'll be back for another episode in August. Until next time.